The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
It's the University of Michigan. It's Juwan Howard. He's one of the biggest names in all of college coaching, period, because he coaches at Michigan and because he had a long and storied college and NBA career. And this is assault. It appears to me that Howard has an open hand that makes contact with Wisconsin assistant Joe Krabbenhoff, who appears to be coming to Greg Gard's assist here. So in the post game, and we heard what Gard said to Andrew Catalan and Steve Lapis after the game, Howard is angry that Gard called a timeout late, but Gard explained he was only calling timeout because he had backups in and Howard was pressing Wisconsin when the game was decided. Then you have a huge scuffle here. Look at this. We have a serious scuffle with actual closed fist punches thrown by members of both teams.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, I actually didn't see that game, nor did I see that altercation till later. Monsignor Stuart Sweatland, longtime host here on our network and a good friend of the show here, actually contacted one of my producers and says, oh my gosh, did you see what happened? Just as a follow-up to the story, disciplinary actions are expected from the Big Ten Conference after Michigan's basketball coach, Juwan Howard, slapped a Wisconsin assistant in the post-game handshake. I saw this earlier today. I went and I looked at the video. He had to reach over like two or three people to smack this guy in the side of the head. And I'm thinking, yeah, what has ever happened to sportsmanship? So the conference issued a statement Sunday night after Wisconsin beat Michigan 77-63 at the Kohl Center in Madison, Wisconsin. But it really is telling, I think, on a number of levels. And I want to talk about it. We'll also talk a little bit later about what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. Monsignor, of course, served our U.S. military for quite a while, and I always enjoy not only talking to him, but getting the moral perspective on how we should view these issues and really what's at stake. So we'll tap into his genius in a second. Let me give you just a little background on this story, just so you better understand what's happening. There's a couple things here. I thought maybe we could talk just about sportsmanship, and feel free to sound off. If you want to join me, 888-914-9149. I always love these stories. In fact, Father Rocky, our chief executive officer, sent me an email when the Olympics were going on, right, about a person who chose sportsmanship over a medal. And you know, the Olympics, and I'll be honest, I boycotted them. I didn't want to watch them because of the genocide of the Uyghurs and what's going on over there. I didn't want to give NBC any ratings. I didn't want China to think that, you know, we didn't care. And yeah, did my one TV make a difference? I don't know, but I know a lot of people who didn't watch it. I was tempted. I always enjoy the Olympics. Winter Olympics are fun. But the Olympics themselves, they're just built on this premise, right? That this is a competition, a friendly competition between different nations. You know, good international relationships promote sportsmanlike behavior. And a little bit of good news for you, right, in the midst of all this darkness. That was on full display last week in Beijing when a Dutch speed skater was coming up to another Canadian speed skater and was expected to win the medal on this race. And he was on his way to doing that, but because of some rules in the sports, he realized he didn't have enough time to pass his competitor in a way that would avoid a collision. So he got out of his racing crouch, and he glided into the finish line dead last. He was disappointed, of course, but he figured it was better than being disqualified. The Canadian, of course, thanked him for that. And it was the ultimate form of I don't know. I don't know if I, you know, I hope I do the right thing, but I almost want to see if I can't amp up a little more speed, or if I cut him off, maybe the guy should slow down, you know. But that's what he did. He made that sacrifice. That's the kind of lesson, though, that doesn't get learned, right? Not everybody embraces that. The story that Monsignor Sweatland brought to us was about a Big Ten college basketball game in Wisconsin. Wisconsin was leading Michigan by 15 points. They had 15 seconds left in the game when the Wisconsin coach called a timeout. That didn't go over well with Michigan. And as the game ended, they were lining up to shake hands. The Michigan coach, you know, and I guess the Wisconsin coach, they got into a heated exchange that was broken up. And then, you know, the Michigan coach and the Wisconsin assistant coach started arguing. And this guy named Howard, basically, Juwan Howard, slapped the other coach in the face. and a melee broke out. The NCAA said, you know, they're looking at the incident and they'll probably issue punishments, appropriate punishments in due time, but who knows. Final note here. Because of this story, there was a columnist who, when he saw this handshake thing, it called for an end to the handshake line at the end of the game. I don't know how you feel about that. I played baseball, and I played for a losing team. We never won a game. So I'm always going up, shaking my opponent's hand, good game, good game, good game. You know, it was like, we were losers. It was hard. We were like the Bad News Bears. We were worse, right? Should we do away with those lines? You know, the losing team never wants to shake hands. That's what this guy's proposing. I don't think so. The issue is a couple of coaches got hot-headed, right? They got heated. They weren't able to control their anger. They lost their tempers. The fist flew. And I think that's unfortunate. But I thought it's a good opportunity for us to talk about sportsmanship today. And I've invited Monsignor Sweatland, who is now the president of Donnelly College in Kansas City, Kansas, to give us his perspective on it. Always good to have you here, Monsignor. Thank you for joining me.
Great to be with you, Drew. Yes, I love sports. Full disclosure, I played basketball myself when I was a younger person and still follow sports. Matter of fact, get the Big Ten Network so I can follow the Fighting Illini and the other teams in the Big Ten. Obviously, being out here in Kansas, basketball is crazy out here, and KU is one of the teams that is always featured, Kansas State as well. But when I saw that comment from Dickie Vitale, about doing away with the handshake after the game, right, and after I saw the fight, I actually was watching the game and saw the end of it. I really felt that we needed to, as a society again, think about the role of sports, especially the role of sports in higher ed. As an educator, as a college president, you know, sports at college is about, well, sports everywhere should be about forming virtue. And, you know, the Popes had said some wonderful things about the proper role of sport to develop character and to develop virtue. Pius XII has said some wonderful things in that in that direction. So did St. John Paul II, who was a sportsman himself. So we've lost the focus on what sports should be about, which is forming virtue. It's not about winning and losing. It's about forming virtuous people. Now, of course, you play the sport to win. You play hard. You play within the rules. But, you know, what people are proposing, because there's a problem in the handshake line, let's do away with the handshake line.
Right.
This is typical of America right now. We want to avoid difficult moral issues by coming up with a solution that does away with the conflict without dealing with the real issue, which is sports should be about teaching good sportsmanship and the other virtues.
It comes down really to virtue, if you think about it, doesn't it? And I think we have lost that sense of virtue, or of, we're not embracing it. And that's why you can see, when I saw the video, I watched it this morning, I couldn't believe an adult would behave that way. It's really quite ridiculous. And I see parents, not just coaches, do the same thing. A year or two ago, I remember seeing some parents getting off out of the stands at a basketball game and hitting a referee because they didn't like the call, or harassing referees at their kids' little league games. The game itself, sports, can really teach us a lot about virtue. What do you think undergirds a lot of this? Are these just anomalies? Most people aren't like this, I would assume. Or have we become coarsened as a society, as a culture, and this is becoming much more common?
Yes, I think the focus of sports, even at the college level, and especially at the high college level now, has become a win at all costs. So much money is involved, so much, a coach has to win or he's going to be fired. And so, you know, his focus can easily get misplaced. And, they lose the sense of what sport's about. You know, a few years ago, I was reading a book called Season of Life, which was about the Gillum football team in Maryland. This was back when I was at Mount St. Mary's. Mm-hmm. Gillum kept winning state championships, even though it's a relatively small school in Maryland. And one of the things their coaches recognized, he was asked after a winning season, he was asked if he'd call it a successful season. And he said, well, tell me what kind of men these boys became. Tell me in 20 years what they have achieved. Are they good fathers? Are they good sons? Are they good brothers? Are they good friends? Are they honest businessmen in the world? If that's happened, it's been a good season. If it doesn't, it hasn't been a good season.
No,
there's a coach who understands the proper role of sports. He's in the business of forming, in his case, high school boys to become men. And at the college level, they should be forming those young men to become outstanding older men and leaders in our society and in their sports.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, if you want to join us, my guest, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland, we're talking about sportsmanship and where we are both as a society, as a culture, and you can get in right now if you'd like to at 888-914-9149. I only have Monsignor for a short time today, but I know he'd love to talk with you. 888-914-9149. Just following up on your point there, sharing those stories. I know the popes have written, about sportsmanship and about the virtue we can glean from athletics. John Paul II was quite athletic in his younger days, and he said a lot of very positive things about sports, but so did Pius XII. You know, from our popes, Monsignor, what are some of those themes that they've often brought forward? Because we think of sports sometimes as simply being, godless. It's just for simple entertainment, but I think there's so much more to that, and I think the Vicar of Christ recognized that as well. So, your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, here's one quotation from Pius XII, and he did this in 1945. There were some other things going on in the world in 1945, but he thought sports were so important in rebuilding Europe that in July of 45, he said this about sports. He said, "Sport, properly directed, develops character, makes a man courageous, a generous loser and a gracious victor. It refines the senses, gives intellectual penetration, and steels the will to endurance. It is not merely a physical development, then. Sport, rightly understood, is an occupation of the whole person. And while perfecting the body as an instrument of the mind, it also makes the mind itself a more refined instrument for the search and communication of truth, and helps man to achieve that end to which all others must be subservient, the service and praise of his Creator." I think Pius XII that got it right. The focus of sport is on making more virtuous men and women. Develop character, in other words. And all of it has to be integrated, like everything in our lives, to the greater glory of God.
Amen to that. I'm getting word from my producer, Patrick, today. He's saying that, Monsignor's a follow-up. Juwan Howard was suspended for the last 5 games of the regular season. So apparently they did come out and issue some sort of punishment for those actions. We're talking also, after that happened, a lot of people are saying they want to do away with the handshake line. And some players will maybe handshake individually on their own, but let's do away with two teams meeting up. Jeff is listening in Milwaukee. He wants to sound off on that. Jeff, hi, you're on the air with Monsignor Sweatland. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. I think the handshake has to stay. You know, it just shows good sportsmanship, and that's what it's all about. You know, you're going to win, you're going to lose, but at the end of the day, you did your best job, and you shake everybody's hand, the coaches, and it's respect, and you got to get that, and you got to have it, because it's so needed in sports. Yeah. And it's important that we have that.
Jeff,
we can't do away with it.
You coached college basketball, is that what I understand?
Yeah, AAU, college, high school. A lot of it was done in our Catholic leagues. Some was public. And I'll tell you, it's just such a great thing to see two teams and coaches come together at the end and for a hard-fought game and to say, "Great job, I'll see you again." Yeah. Good or bad, I mean, it's a good thing, and we need that. You can never, ever do away with that.
All right. Jeff, thanks for the call. Monsignor, I'll let you respond.
Yeah, so it was a great example of this in Kansas City at the Bills-Chiefs game. After that hard-fought game in the playoffs where the Chiefs came from, won in overtime, Mahomes, they're trying to interview him on live television, and he said, "I've got to go." And he ran the field to find the other quarterback to congratulate him from the Bills. And I said a great example here in Kansas City of what sport is supposed to be about. You know, if we look at each other as brothers and sisters and we see each other on the playing field as opponents but not enemies, then at the end of the day we should be able to shake hands, look each other in the eye, and say, "Good job." And I hope that, we don't duck hard moral issues by coming up with ways to avoid the conflict. You see, that's what we do with the life issue. We don't want to solve the issue and recognize the human life present in the womb, so we come up with a gadget or a gimmick like pro-choice where we leave it up to the woman. Well, of course, what ends up happening is innocent children die. And so we, you know, we're avoiding tough moral questions. If we avoid the handshake just because we haven't made the commitment to virtue and sportsmanship, then we're just avoiding developing more moral persons. Now, I got to give Juwan Howard credit. His he has put out an apology, which I think is very heartfelt and very well put together, where he really takes responsibility, saying it was inexcusable. Yeah. And he's gotten a 5-game suspension. But I hope every coach out there, and I'm glad we had a coach on the line, every coach out there sees themselves as an educator and a formator, because that's what coaches do. The best coaches educate and form people to be more virtuous.
Oh, Kevin's listening in West Covina, California. He's actually a coach, a high school football coach. Kevin, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Drew. And my comment was that, you know, I think it's ludicrous, and I know, you know, Dickie V has been in the game for, you know, decades and is a big voice in college basketball. But, you know, you got to learn how to adverse situations in life, especially, you know, failure. Mm-hmm. And if losing a basketball game is considered failure at that point in time, you got to teach kids how to respond to that. And oftentimes in handshakes, you'll see there's a lot of respect for each other, and you can actually gain respect for kids, or for kids can with each other with that handshake, and just, you know, acknowledging that the other team played better or had a great game or whatever it was. But, you know, we got to learn how to handle failures in life. And the way I see society a lot of times now is parents are, you know, looking for excuses for why their sons aren't being successful, and whatever it is, it doesn't matter what it is. And there's not a lot of accountability involved, I think, in the home nowadays. And social media is a big part of that, I think. And it's just, you know, it's unfortunate that he would say that, you know, take the handshake away, when that's the time to celebrate people's successes and failures at the same time, and just kind of come together as you know, they're in this thing together called, in this sense, basketball, and just the respect that you get out of that as well, you know. So I think failure is, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I'll let you finish, Kevin. I was just going to say, as a football coach, you know, what do you teach those kids? What do you say to them, you know, in terms of how to respond both to defeat as well as victory?
So just, I want to say this. I was at a Catholic school for 22 years as a head coach in LA, and I'm at the public school now. And so my whole mission is to glorify God through the game of football. And so it's really important. What we teach the kids, what we teach, we respond, is just how to respect each other and be humble and show humility in successes and failures. And we're all in this thing together, this thing, game called life. But in this particular instance, we're talking about a game called football. And so, you know, it's a microcosm of what they're going to see later on in life. So we're trying to teach them, you know, and you mentioned it, Father, like we, you know, and as corny as it sounds, you know, I tell the parents in our parent meetings and the kids we speak to, is that our number one goal in our program is that we want to lead kids to Christ. That's number one. Number two, we want to lead them into college and be successful to graduate from college. And number three, we're trying to win CIF championships, and it's in that order, and we don't mix that up. And I'm not apologetic for not winning, and we've been very successful. I mean, we've had some really good teams and really good. I coached the Heisman Trophy at my former high school, Bryce Young, who won it this year. So, I'd like to name drop that, but you know, we don't mix that. We don't mix that order up, and so, you know, in no sense, in no way do we belittle opponents. And it's hard because the streets tell you otherwise. They tell you to get respect for you, give respect. Yeah. And that's not how real life is. And that's how you get in trouble. And that stuff. So anyway, we try to teach the right perspective on life and building young men to be great men, just like you said, Father.
Kevin, thank you for fulfilling your vocation, you know, because that's really what you're doing. You're bringing holiness through the game of football. You're helping to form, you know, future men. I think it's fantastic. And Monsignor, I love what he had to say. So much packed in there. But you know, one, respect. You know, you can lose or you can win. You still have that mutual respect. And then the lesson of humility, so often that is lost. So many virtues that can be learned from it. But I'll let you respond to Kevin as well and your thoughts, your takeaways from him.
No, I love how he's committed to be an educator, as a coach, and, you know, forming those young men entrusted to his care. you know, I mentioned Gillum High School in Maryland, but, you know, I was amazed to find out that their chant, you know, every team has a chant they use in the huddle, you know, respond to, just like we have a responsorial psalm as Catholics at Mass. And at Gillum High School, the coaches come in, and this is their chant. They say to the players, "What's our job?" And the players respond to the coaches, "To love us." And then their next question, the coaches go, "And what's your job?" And the response is, "To love one another." And that's how that team, a multi-state championship team, was put together, that their commitment to love one another as brothers, and the coaches as big brothers or fathers to that young, and that they would never yell at a player, they never cut a player, and yet they produced state championship after state championship because they were built on good biblical principles of virtue formation, faith formation, and loving one another. So they used to say, "You keep a block on that tackle for 3 seconds because you love your brother who's going to carry the football behind you, and you don't want him flattened, so you're going to hold that block for 3 seconds." And that's how people did it, and they won championships doing that. And that's a coach who understands it's about virtue formation.
Again, Kevin, thank you. Love the call. Maggie even said to me into my call screen, "I love these men." I agree. Monsieur, I didn't realize, but Tom was telling me earlier, my other producer, that you're not just the president of Donnelly College, but you have a parish to take care of as well. What kind of things are you seeing with the parents and sports for kids and living out their lives in church? What are you seeing now as a pastor in that environment?
Right. That's one of the things I'm really pleased. My parish, it's predominantly African-American parish, Our Lady in St. Rose here in Kansas City. And I love to see that the parents are making Sunday Mass a priority, where people are coming back to in person. You know, we really got, we're about 80% now of our congregation back, which is good. We're hoping to, you know, get 100% soon. But the, you know, the young people are making that commitment that Sunday morning is for the Lord. And, you know, so many times the sports want to compete with that time, and the parents have made a commitment, no, this is going to be sacrosanct time, and it's not going to have practices, it's not going to have games, and we're going to make this a priority. I love to see that, and I think that's an important part of putting sports in perspective. Sports is important and helpful and can be part of a solid educational system, but God has to come first. And so I love to see that commitment in the parish.
Hey, Monsignor, before I let you go, I want to get your take on Ukraine and Russia and the aggressive posturing of Russia right now. I know you were in service with our U.S. military for a long time, especially during the Cold War. And you know Vladimir Putin, and you know where this can all lead. In some respects, it looks like the U.S. and Europe have lost the post-Cold War. Your take on where we are, and just as a military person and as a scholar, as a theologian, as a priest, what do you see coming in the days ahead, and how should we respond?
Tyrants must be, and bullies must be stood up to, or they'll continue their tyranny and their aggression. Putin has committed the crime of aggression in the Crimea, and now he's doing it. He's done it in other countries too, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Belarus. But now he's doing it even in more parts of Ukraine, and the world has to stand up. This man has been a crook and a criminal and a tyrant, and now he's committed the international crime of aggression against his neighbors. And just like we saw in the 20th century, if you don't stand up to such people, eventually, you know, they'll roll. The tanks will continue to roll. Let's put it that way. So how we do that, though, has to be done prudently and intelligently, and it needs to be targeted in such a way that it won't hurt the innocent. And there are innocents on both sides. You know, the innocent people who are under the thumb of Putin in Russia, and the innocent people who are there in Ukraine. So we have to be very targeted, very careful, very proportionate in our response. But we must respond, and respond in a way that aggression will not pay. You know, this is someone who's committed a war crime, and I don't think, sadly, in our world that all the criminals are held accountable for their crimes. But Putin, since he was an assistant mayor in St. Petersburg, many years ago, he's been known to be a crook, and he's also been known to be a person who only responds with force. And he doesn't respect international law or morality. And we just have to recognize that. That's who we're dealing with.
Monsignor, thank you. Always great to talk with you. I'll have to bring you back. Maybe we can talk a little bit about some of the moral underpinnings of what we're seeing with Russia in the days ahead. Keep up your great work there. If anyone wants to learn a little bit more about Donnelly College, I'm assuming it's just donnellycollege.edu. Is that the best way to connect?
It's donnelly.edu.
Sorry about that. I always get it wrong. Donnelly.edu.
No, it's donnelly.edu. Yep.
All right. Hey, Monsignor, thank you. Great talking with you.
God bless you.
God bless you. Stay with me. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Russia has always been saying that they have built a fortress, right, in supplying themselves with enough reserves to withstand any sanctions from the West, but questioned whether the West would be able to withstand any after effect, meaning the threat of oil and gas not flowing to Europe at the rate that it was. We heard that threat and that tweet from Dmitry Medvedev earlier. What can investors expect to see and Americans expect to see in terms of markets?
What's important here is that Nord Stream 2 is a really important sign of German, U.S., and NATO unity on this front here, because this is important. A third of all of the natural gas consumed by the EU is from Russia. So that Nord Stream 2 pipeline, really incredibly important here. Global oil prices is where you're seeing this. Putin's provocation, his obsession with Ukraine, threatens global stability. Already, this is feeding into this global inflation story that we've been talking about. Oil prices around the world nearing $100 a barrel.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Crazy, isn't it? $100 a barrel, depending on what we see. The cost of oil and gas may continue to climb. Good afternoon. I'm Drew Mariani. It is good to be with you this afternoon and reflecting on what we're now seeing with Russia going into Ukraine and where this may lead. You heard about you heard how critical energy is, how much we used to provide. And I wish we could, as a nation, provide the energy needs to our European allies. The Nord Stream pipeline, of course, is now being put on hold as a response to Vladimir Putin's aggression. But with Russia invading Ukraine, I'm just going to put this on your radar, and I want to talk about the connection between energy and national security. Oil prices are going to go up, and I'm assuming gas prices are going to follow. But here's an interesting fact you may not know. This shocked me when I saw this. The United States is actually buying 844,000, just shy of a million barrels of oil from Russia a day. Can you believe that? At least that's how much our country was buying back in May. Okay, maybe that's changed, but we weren't able to find the most current data. But I think that's a pretty good number. You know, people who found that information, they paired it to another piece of information. That of the Keystone Pipeline, right? Remember when Biden took office, very first day, he was sworn in, he took his pen and issued a lot of executive orders. President Biden canceled on his first day in office what would have carried 800,000 gallons of oil a day from Canada down to the Gulf Coast. And of course, if he hadn't canceled it, it would still be under construction and it would be a while before those 800,000 barrels would be flowing through it on a daily basis. But still, that was stricken. A lot of environmental concerns. And as a result of it, a lot of people were out of work. And we see our own energy dependence. Instead of being energy independent, relying on our natural resources, we're buying oil from Russia, amongst other nations. But here's the thing. The president did cancel it. And he somehow or other, he ended our energy independence. Trump knew that that was an important thing to do. Up until the current occupant at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., too often the U.S. was energy independent. In fact, we were exporting oil and gas because we had that much coming in. But within just a couple months, we went from energy independence to begging OPEC, asking them, can you step up production so that the price of oil will go down? OPEC took a look at that request They took a look at the balance sheets, which were getting blacker by the minute. You know what they said to us? Nah, don't think so. No thanks. Again, policy. This is all about policy. It's about ideology, too, that undergirds a lot of that policy. Not only we lost our energy independence, it appears that there's going to be no way of getting it back over the next 3 years. I mean, we are going to have this administration for the next 3 years. Now, you know, we could be facing a European conflict or who knows what lies in the future. The Biden administration is planning to add even more regulations to future pipelines and all these, you know, other energy products from fossil fuels. And I think in some respects they're doing this because if they make oil, they make gas costly and prohibitive, it's going to make people, you know, it's going to make, you know, green energy, electric, far more palatable, far more attractive to others. But again, as I was saying a little bit earlier, Vladimir Putin's going into Ukraine. Take a look at the minerals that are in there. Take a look at the resources that Russia has in terms of, and China in terms of our reliance on them, even for the batteries, the technologies to make these batteries. This is a huge issue. And I do want to dive into it a little bit deeper because I do think we need to be very aware of what our energy policy is. You know, if for some reason they do issue more regulations, you know, on not just future pipelines, but other energy products from fossil fuels, it's going to make it harder for people to get gas, to get oil, to get natural gas that they need for transportation, heating their homes, cooking their food. I want to talk about it. It's something that, you know, I'm still learning a lot about. I want to bring you up to speed as well and take a look at not only where we stand here in America, what it's going to look like in 3 years, and ultimately how critical this is. You know, energy policy is intricately connected to our national security. I've invited a senior policy analyst for energy and environmental issues in the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation to join me. Katie Tubb said she'd love to, and she's pulled up a chair. Hi, Katie. Good to have you with me today.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for having me on.
Boy, I mean, so much going on. It's frustrating for me as I see what's happening here in this country. And the fact that we went from energy independence to being dependent again, not just on Saudi Arabia and OPEC oil, but when I discovered how much oil we were buying a day from Russia, that was very telling. I'd love your perspective on this. How did we make that transition? And how dangerous is it for the future of this country?
Yeah, I think, Drew, I like how you framed it earlier about this is the consequence of policy. This is about policy and ideology. And, you know, I don't think we could get more of a contrast between the previous administration and this administration when it comes to energy policy, in that the Biden administration has really been pushing a regulatory agenda and an agenda from the bully pulpit of saying oil and gas, coal, you have no future in this country. The future is renewables. And that may be where the market is going, but the problem is when you're using policy to try and manhandle the private sector into a politically preferred direction. And I think we're seeing the consequences of that now. You know, energy prices are high around the world, and some of that certainly has to do with economic recovery as governments loosen up on pandemic policies. But I think where we're seeing a lot of the friction is long existing policies, particularly in Europe and now under the Biden administration, that are reducing people's options to adjust to high energy prices. A great example is coal. We've killed coal in a lot of ways in this country. And when natural gas prices are high, coal is a great place to switch fuels to, mm-hmm. to relieve some of that high demand and let prices adjust. And under the regulatory structure we have now and under this administration, that is increasingly hard to do, to be flexible in a changing environment. And then on top of that, just as you were saying earlier, we've got the Russia situation, which is throwing energy markets into basically crisis mode, as we're now looking at $100 a barrel for oil. So it'll probably go has consequences.
It'll probably go higher too, I'm assuming. You know, to coal, let's talk about coal for a second, because I had heard recently, and I know there's a lot of environmental concerns here in this country and a lot of other nations, Europe. I mean, Germany's done away with their nuclear energy, or at least has begun to wean off of that. It makes them more dependent, of course, on Russia for the gas, for the pipeline there. But China, they're all in on coal right now. In fact, I think they're opening more coal plants as well. So, you know, it seems that nations are playing by different roles. And does that make us more vulnerable? And how do you resolve that? If China and Russia say, hey, we're going to do this, and the U.S., we're going to be leaders, we're going to do X, and yet the American citizenry suffer economically, and our national security suffers. I'd love you to address that.
Yeah, I think, well, and just to underscore your point about China, their energy consumption has exploded over the last, I would say, 20, 30 years. And to wit, you know, a couple days ago, Russia and China just inked a new deal on coal exports. So they're very much pushing forward on energy consumption. I think the Biden administration likes to think that they're leading on energy and climate, and I think reality is telling us otherwise. Mm-hmm. And you're right, we're paying the consequences. Russia and China are living in a different world than the Biden administration would like to see the world as.
That's wild. My guest today is Katie Tubb. Hey, if you want to join us, I'll open the phones. If you've got a question, a comment, an insight, it's 888-914-9149. You can call now, 888-914-9149. You know, when the president took the Oval Office, whipped out that executive pen, canceled the Keystone Pipeline, that was in process of being built when, you know, President Biden canceled it. How important was that pipeline to maintaining our independence, at least from countries like, say, Saudi Arabia or even Russia? Because that oil would have been coming from Canada, our neighbors to the north. Give me a perspective on the Keystone Pipeline.
Well, I think, you know, I like to reframe energy independence as energy freedom. Under mm-hmm. the Biden administration, we're talking about energy control. And, you know, countries like Canada are incredible partners when it comes to energy supply in both directions. So I like to talk about it in terms of energy freedom, and that's what the Keystone Pipeline was. It was a relationship with a longtime ally and trading partner. And when the Keystone Pipeline was first submitted for that border permit, that was under the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And here we are still talking about the Keystone Pipeline. So I think there's two misfortunes in that saga. One is that we don't have that oil coming down to our refineries in the most efficient and economically and environmentally safe way. The oil will still get to market. It just might not get to American markets. Mm-hmm. And if it does, it will come in a less efficient way. So that's the first misfortune. The second is that Keystone became a political bludgeon that told other industries, watch out, because if your industry becomes politically important, you know, in one way or the other, you're going to be made a lesson of. And that's not good for business, no matter what your industry is. So I think that's where it's incredibly harmful, not just on the energy side, but on the message it communicates to businesses that a politician can make an example of you, and that's not freedom.
Yeah. Hey, I'm going to take a break and take some calls, but let me just follow up on the Keystone Pipeline. I know Pete, I'm going to grab his call too in a minute and say, hey, that wasn't done. So even though Biden canceled it, how does the cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline ultimately hurt America today? You know, when, where was our fuel coming from? Was it from the you know, natural reserves up in Alaska? I mean, where were we getting our resources before Biden began to shut all that off?
Mm-hmm. Well, thankfully, there's still a lot that America has to offer for its citizens and for the world. And that's because so much of our energy is on state and private lands that are a little bit harder for the administration to meddle with. So Americans get our energy from a variety of sources, a lot of which is homegrown. But as you mentioned, there are other sources, including Russia. And right now that's politically a problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Stay with me, Katie. We'll take a short break when we come back. We'll talk more. I only have a few minutes remaining with everyone today. I hope you can join us. If you want to dial in, feel free to do that. The number here is 888-914-9149. Taking a look at energy, energy freedom, national security, all that's unfolding internationally, and how it may affect you in the not-too-distant future. Stay with me. The conversation continues right after this. Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep your station running. Join in with thousands of other listeners who have given their unused vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
Well, thanks for tuning in and joining me. If you missed any part of our conversation today, we've had a great 3 hours together. You can go to relevantradio.com and go to my show page, the Drew Mariani Show page. You'll find our archives. Maggie gets our podcasts up probably about an hour after we're off the air. And please share it with others. You know, get people plugged into the program and get a good moral perspective on a lot of these issues. If you're just joining me, yeah, I've really been watching the cost of oil, $100 a barrel, right? You know how expensive it is right now at the gas pump. Maybe you got your heating bill. You see how big that is. And with tensions now mounting, the threat of potential war, maybe even cyber attack and a lot of other things. Remember what happened with the Colonial Pipeline when that got shut down? Could we see other things like that? How high could this go? What's it going to mean to you? I thought we'd take a look at energy, the energy freedom, our connection to national security with Katie Tubbs. She's Senior Policy Analyst for Energy and Environmental Issues in the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And Katie, let me pick up on regulation, on this aspect, then we'll jump into the phones, okay? These regulations that the Energy Department wants to add, would they actually do anything to lower pollution in the air, you know, that we breathe, the water that we drink? If those regulations are put in place, you know, and if there's a chance there's a change in administration in 3 years, how long will it take for the new administration to get rid of those regs? So kind of two things there. What will the regulations do? Do they really benefit the environment? And secondly, you know, we have a changing administration in 36 months, potentially. How does that all play out?
Yeah, to me, the regulatory piece is really important. And I think more Americans need to understand what's going on in their government, because the Biden administration, right out the gate, set out on a pretty aggressive regulatory agenda on energy. And I'm talking about everything from financing to exploration, production, distribution, and even consumer access to energy. And so basically what they're trying to do is use regulations to discourage the use of coal, oil, and natural gas, and to subsidize the use of wind and solar. And it's not that I'm anti-wind and solar. It's that I am pro-consumer. And so that's a huge issue that I think people need to be watching. On the environmental side of your question, none of this has anything to do with the environment. It has nothing to do with reducing, you know, soot in the air or improving our water quality. It has everything to do with the administration's view towards climate change. But unfortunately, no matter what you think about climate change, these regulations will have no impact on global temperatures by the end of the century. And that's because countries like China, India, the developing world are driving emissions, and the U.S. has been reducing emissions. So on the environmental side, it feels like it's all cost and no benefit. And on the, you know, your second question about a future administration, if there's a new administration that has a very different approach to this, it will take time to unwind a lot of the work the Biden administration has been doing, not just in the Department of Energy, but the EPA, Department of Interior, Department of Transportation, even Department of Treasury. And that will take some processes and some time to walk through. But to me, that's an argument for Congress to get back in the game, because Americans' representatives are the ones that should be making those policy decisions, and not bureaucrats in the Department of Energy who have no accountability. So it's, to me, it's a case for representative government to work again, for Congress mm-hmm. to get back in the game and give voters their voice as they're due.
So in terms of the U.S. getting energy independent, I think it is important. We're not going to rely on Russian oil or Saudi Arabian oil. I mean, we're begging them to pump oil, and they're saying, nah, we can't help you there, because, you know, it's all about the bottom line for them as well. You know, coal is off the table, even though China has embraced it. Fracking has, you know, come under fierce scrutiny as well. Are there alternative energy sources other than fossil fuels that you are a fan of, or do you think fracking is the way to go? Wind? I mean, where do you stand in terms of where the U.S. should be heading?
You know, I think just holistically, we need to go to a deregulatory posture, and that doesn't mean no regulation. That mm-hmm. means reducing the amount of decision making happening in D.C. Because that's good for all energy resources. That's good for oil, natural gas. That's good for wind and solar. And I think one of the biggest areas we need a regulatory mm-hmm. overhaul and right sizing is nuclear energy. Nuclear energy has a lot to offer. It's a very energy dense resource that provides reliable electricity. But we have almost gotten to the point of regulating nuclear out of the business in this country. So I think that's how I would answer your question, Drew. It's a posture okay. change when it comes to regulation
right.
and
all right.
allowing all of these energy resources to compete, because yeah. we're secure yeah. when we have not just affordable and reliable energy, but
right.
a diverse set of energy.
I could not agree more. Hey, Pete and Glenn and Nick and Mark and Freddie and everyone on hold, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I'm not going to be able to grab your call. And I do want to thank you, Katie, for being with me. If people want to learn more, what's the best way to connect, to read up on, I guess, energy, environmental issues, energy independence, and more, energy freedom, as you put it?
Go to heritage.org, and you can find my work, and you can also see some really good work going on right now on the international side of things as, you know, this Ukraine-Russia situation unfolds. So I'd encourage people to go there for the next step in this learning process.
Yeah, thank you, Katie. It is a learning process. Very grateful for your time and your explanations today. Hopefully we can talk again soon.
Oh, yeah. I would love that. Thank you, Drew.
That's Katie Tubb, senior policy analyst there, and check him out. It's heritage.org. Look, I only have a moment or two left, and I do want to share something a little bit lighter. Some of the conversation today has been pretty heavy, right? Everything from Russia rolling into Ukraine to our energy and so much more. Today is kind of a weird day, right? Today is Tuesday. And I almost mean that literally, February 22nd, right? The world hit an unprecedented milestone. We won't see a day like this again for 400 years, they say. It's a date, 2-22-22. And again, it falls on a Tuesday, no less. Maggie did a little bit of research into this. She found an interesting look at this unique day. Today is a once-in-a-lifetime day. Check it out.
Today is a once-in-a-lifetime day because of the date.
Yes, today is 2-22-22, so people are calling it Tuesday with a 2 instead of a T-U-E-S. The last time a palindrome date like this occurred on a Tuesday was back in 1622, and it won't happen again until the year 2422. So to celebrate, companies are offering special deals and giveaways, including Venmo, who's giving a few dozen people who share their Tuesday post on social media $222. So there it is. It's Tuesday. It's also National Margarita Day.
Oh,
it's
even better.
Taco Tuesday. It's all lining up. There's something crazy going on here.
So, yeah, we're not going to see this again for a while, but we're going to hit Threesday, right? Tuesday, Threesday. That's a stretch, right? 3-3-33. So March 3rd, 2020. I know it's bad. Maggie's saying so bad. It is, Maggie. But that's 11 years from now. You'll hit Fours Day 11 years after that. So we got a few more of these days that you and I you and I will see. I heard you in my headsets, I think, when you heard in that piece I'm talking about it being Taco Tuesday, but Margarita Tuesday, huh? You like margaritas, Maggie? Maggie, I don't hear you. Yeah. I say Maggie's in my headset. She says she certainly does. That's for sure. So, well, you know, look, I hope you enjoy your Taco Tuesday, your Margarita Tuesday, your Tuesday as well. We've got a lot more coming up here for you. Cale Clark is going to follow the show. Don't forget, as I wrap it up here today, to sign up for Father's Lenten Lessons. Okay, Lenten Lessons on the Mass. Simply go to relevantradio.com. Starting tomorrow, we are 1 week away from Lent, 1 week away from Ash Wednesday. And I'm going to hit it hard this Lent, spiritually and even physically. I invite you to join me. I think we need to really to pray, to fast, to offer our sacrifices, to ask God to intervene in the world on so many different levels. And, of course, I'll be praying for you throughout Lent. I prayed a chapel before I went on the air today for you as well. One final note as I leave you today. Right after the Chapel of the Divine Mercy in my second hour today, I want to encourage you to go back. If you're just tuning in, I shared a little bit about a gift that the Lord gave to St. Faustina and he gave to you. Today's the anniversary of the day that the image of Divine Mercy was given. Take a listen to that conversation and then get an image. I think you'll be glad you did. It's well worth listening to that, okay? I'm going to take a short pause. I got to wrap it up, actually. I wish I could spend more time with you. But Cale Clark's coming up. Till tomorrow, God bless.